Welcome to Elaine's Literary Salon Podcast. I'm Jeffrey James Higgins. My wife Cynthia and I own Elaine's Literary Salon in Old Town Alexandria, and it's become the literary hub for the D.C. area. Today, we are reaching across the country for a virtual guest, and I'm really looking forward to this one. If you're a writer and hoping to get your work published or on the screen, I think you'll really enjoy this one. So, as Executive Director of Pipeline Media Group, Matthew Joseph Mizutich oversees all divisions, including script, book, and film, as well as the management of Pipeline Artists and the Educational Platform Symposium. He began his tenure with Pipeline in 2006, working as a reader until early 2008, when he took over as manager. In that time, he helped launch the careers of several Pipeline writers, including Evan Doherty, which is Snow White and the Huntsman, Tripper Clancy, Stubber, Crosby Selander, Bring Me Back, and others who have turned to Pipeline for guidance in their creative aspirations. It's estimated he's reviewed over 40,000 pitches, screenplays, pilots, books, and short films over the past two decades. 40,000. Dear God, you should take a nap.
I got to update that. I think it's closer to 75,000.
You're kidding me. 75,000.
I did the estimated count. Not like notes on everyone, but, you know, gone through.
That's insane. That is insane. Well, we're going to talk about that. In 2024, he joined the Greenlight Committee of V42 as part of the team reviewing potential film projects. He's based in Los Angeles, writes fiction, and is a partner at independent publisher Fringe Press. Welcome, Matt. Good to have you on the podcast.
Yes, it is lovely to be here. And I've got my Fringe Press hat on today.
That's really
new.
Cool.
Straight from Etsy. Yeah, you'll see it at future conferences, I'm sure.
So we met at BoucherCon, is that right? The writers' conference down in New Orleans?
We met, I think we met before that at one of the other BoucherCons, perhaps.
They all blend together, don't they?
They did, but we this one stuck for us.
And I met Chloe, I believe, was one of your partners on the Fringe Press. Am I remembering her name correctly?
Zoe.
Zoe, that's right, Zoe. Yeah, that's
remarkably close.
Yeah, well, that's good. That'll be the first of many names I can crucify during our talk today. So,
that's okay. It's also Stuber instead of Stubber, but that's a hard one to pronounce. The Tripper Fantasy movie from my bio.
All right, so we're 0-2. That's great. So tell me about Fringe Press. I mean, this is kind of interesting. Sure. So this is sort of like you guys are tackling like alternative writing, right? That's having a tough time breaking into the mainstream market.
Yeah, essentially. Or it's a book that we got our hands on and convinced the writer to go with us before someone else snagged them. But I'll give you the very brief history of it. So author Lee Matthew Goldberg, who's been around a long time, he's published, I think, 17 novels now, writes thrillers, writes YA. He and I have known each other for a long time. He was actually a Script Pipeline finalist of ours from 2011 or something, so it's been a long time. A few years ago, he told me he was launching a publishing company called Fringe, and we did exactly what you were saying, looking for stuff that's kind of like on the fringe, hence the name, of the publishing industry, stuff that like the big five would like never publish, but also stuff that has a little leaning toward film and TV adaptation. And he asked me, like, hey, do you want to, like, help support it somehow or, like, read our published books? And it just kind of morphed into there of becoming partners with him, with Pipeline and him. And then he brought on Zoe as editor at a later point. And now we're here, and our first book is coming out in March, and it's a period horror. And it's called Hail Holy Queens, and everyone should go out and get the limited hardcover edition available only on fringepublishers.com. I don't know if we're going to do that yet, but I think we're going to do that.
Oh, that's really interesting. So I have so many questions about this, by the way. And sure. Zoe seemed really sharp. It was fun chatting with her. I believe I met her at BoucherCon too. So you say you're doing a limited edition, but you're only doing it through your website. Is that right?
I'm finalizing. This is in progress as we speak. I'm still trying to figure out the best way to roll it out, and I think sell the rest of the team on this idea, because I can turn my camera around. You can see my wall of baseball cards, like in the cases and the rows and stuff. But I come from a more collectible mindset, collecting comics and baseball cards and stuff. So I wanted to come out with like do this like A24 style, A24 the movie studio who does these hardcover editions of the scripts and like these, you know, collectible set type of things, signed posters and things. And I wanted to do just like a 50 or 100 copy, nice hardcover print run. We have our cover design now. It looks really great. Sign it and hand number it and just sell them on the site and, you know, see how that goes. But mainly to establish this as sort of like a small press that's a little bit more premium, I guess, optics-wise. You know, I want to present this as something that, hey, we want to find quality stuff that's really cool and that feels like, you know, truly indie in a sense. So that kind of aligned with it. That's a longer explanation of the hardcover process than you asked for. But that is my thinking anyway.
No, it's really interesting, and I love that you're sharing that too at this early stage when you haven't even quite landed on it. But you know, it's fun. It's fun to hear the process. Yeah, I think you're really hitting on something, especially right now with the limited copies. And I know especially younger readers, they've been really gravitating towards books with like nice covers and texture to them and beautiful covers and something different that they can like an object they can actually hold in their hands, because they spend all day on the phone and in this digital world. And while that's great and we all consume content like that, books are beautiful. And it's nice actually having something that you can hold on to.
And I think you hit on something else that I strongly believe in. I think this next generation is going a little bit more low tech. They want to kind of get off their phones. They want to get off the tablets. And, you know, they're listening to records again. They're buying hardcover books. Remember when you thought the hardcover or the actual physical book industry would be dead by now? And it's not at all, right? I'm just kind of trying to lean into that a little bit.
What's interesting is, you know, even if people are going for that, and I love that you're doing the, you know, like numbered copies and you're giving something extra, right, to dive in. But I wonder how the, like, just having it on your website is going to work, because like 70-80% of all book sales are on Amazon right now. And, you know, a big part of it's discoverability when you've got like 3 million books a year coming out. I wonder not having it available there if that's going to hurt.
Yeah, my thinking is, and part of the reason that Pipeline meshed so well with what Lee was doing with Fringe is that we already have a big built-in audience. So my hope is that, you know, you target that audience first who looks at Pipeline and sort of expects a more – I won't get into the whole history of our Pipeline mugs. I won't even explain what those are, but they're basically – I mean, it is what it – What the two words mean. They're sort of these Pipeline mugs that we would give away during the pandemic on back when it was Twitter. And they were the most popular thing. It would just be, I would have like a little, you know, quote, or not a quote, but a tagline or something on the side, and our logo on the other side, and people love them. So I'm banking on our audience sort of snagging a hardcover edition first, and maybe they just live on the site for a while and they just sort of sit there. We, you know, use them as giveaways, as promotions. See, now we have to do it. Lee and Zoe, if you're listening, we've already discussed it in the public forum, so now we have to do the hardcover signed edition.
So is the idea like you maybe do this for a period of time and then you go broader with your distribution as a way to have exclusivity?
Yeah, this is just like the, you know, in the early stages we'll have another option. And Amazon is going to be available, you know, in the regular, you know, print-on-demand version or whatever we're doing. But an actual, like a regular, you know, non-signed, just a hardcover thing on Amazon, I don't know if we're going the hardcover route or what yet. Still early stages. This is giving your audience a peek into the mindset of a person at a publishing company who is not the primary source of information for what the strategy is. That is Lee and Zoe's department. But
yeah, and I mean, he's got a ton of experience, right? But also, nobody really knows the answers to this stuff. You know, sometimes things work, sometimes they don't. If people knew how to do this exactly, then it would work every time, and it doesn't for anybody, Big Five or any publisher.
And I'm trying to like instill my opinions on this whole process just as like a fan and a reader, and like what I would want as a consumer rather than a publisher, an editor who's been in the publishing industry for, you know, 20 plus years that like they have. So trying to do something different with Fringe.
Well, you know, I love the idea of Fringe, and I'm definitely going to be a customer. I'm going to buy that first book. I want to get one of the numbered copies.
I'll gift you a copy.
Well, even better. I'll definitely do that. I'm curious, like, because publishing is a brutal business, right? I think this year there's been like four or five or maybe six publishers that have gone out of business. I know tons of authors who've had like mid-sized presses that have tanked. So, yeah. I mean, it's a hard place to go in, and you have that built-in audience, but you're not just going in as like another publisher. You're going in saying, we're going to do something that like mainstream publishing avoids, right? So yeah. What are the challenges in that? Like, I love getting something new and unique and a different, like, I love that, and I will definitely support that. But does that cause a challenge in the market where you're getting something that people, like, how do you make people want something they don't know they want?
Yes, well, I guess there's two questions secretly embedded in there, and I'll try and answer them both. But the challenge, I think, is it's time and money. And that's all there is. It's just the manpower to do what we want to do. We want to be a lot more hands-on with our marketing, with our promotion of our authors, with all of that, which, not to knock any of the smaller publishers, not to knock any of the bigger publishers for that matter, but not a lot of effort is put into the marketing side of things. They just kind of publish your book and let it sort of go off into the wind, and it does how it does, and you're sort of responsible for it yourself, right? I mean, that's how typically most publishers work. And I get it, because they don't have the infrastructure in place to handle it. So, you know, if we're here and, you know, our first book is coming out in March, we're only planning on publishing maybe two a year to start, two or three a year, and not, you know, 150. So that's going to give us the opportunity, while we ramp up anyway, because we all have, Zoe's an editor, you know, freelance editor, and she has a full-time job as a copy editor, copywriter. Lee, of course, is, you know, a full-time author at this point. So we want to be methodical about it, but we also want to give as much attention to the books that we're publishing as possible. So there's going to be challenges there just as far as time and as far as bandwidth. To your other question on how we stand out, right? Mm-hmm. I don't know. I don't think anybody knows how to do marketing anymore. I think you just kind of like, you know, you look at what's worked and what hasn't worked, and you try and do something different. And that's been the biggest hurdle for us, at least, you know, just looking at what we do with Pipeline and promoting what we're doing there. And we have an educational platform now called Symposium that, you know, we're trying to get the word out on. And it's really, really hard to cut through the noise of the internet, right? I say the internet because I don't know what in-person marketing is so difficult. You know, getting people to go to book signings is its own challenge, right? And just getting people out of the house to do something, to pay attention to you. It's hard, but I've always kind of been a believer that you have to go against the current a little bit in order to cut through the noise. There's an old Levi's ad. I don't know if you're an aficionado of the history of the advertising industry, but there's an old Levi's ad that it's all white sheep, and then there's one black sheep faced the other way, and it's like whenever one zigzag, and that's kind of stuck with me over the years, and I think it's true, especially now.
You know, that's so smart, and it's all. I think you're exactly right, because, you know, some new platform will come up or some new marketing idea, and it works. Then everybody does it, and then there's so much of it out there that you can't send out, so you have to do something new. You know, things that worked in advertising, even like as an author with my own books, that like a year ago don't work right now, and so it changes so rapidly. You have to constantly be on it. But as you're talking about that, I'm thinking that also takes a tremendous amount of courage, right? Because you have to invest time and money into something that hasn't yet worked that you're trying to see if it will.
Right. And you just kind of have to roll with your gut sometimes. And sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. I'm very proud to say that most of the crazy things that I've tried, not crazy, but, you know, the more avant-garde things that we've tried, ended up working just because they felt a little different, you know. I don't think this is a whole other episode about advertising and marketing, but I don't think companies trust their audience as much as they should anymore.
Interesting.
I look at the film industry too, and I don't think they trust that their audience is going to get it. I think everything has been kind of dumbed down a little too much, which maybe I'm wrong. Maybe it should be.
So what is it that you've tried that's been something that's like maybe one example of something that was very different that worked?
Yeah, well, you know what? We've rejected the whole... I don't even know how to, like, what genre of advertising and marketing you would call it, but just, like, the sort of basic, very easy, what everyone's been doing kind of, like, approach to marketing, where you're appealing to the lowest common denominator. So, for example, with Pipeline, we've gone with, like, a more, just in terms of the aesthetic, a more minimalist look, a little bit more classy look, just in the look and feel. So that's one way. You know, coming up with actual advertising campaigns that feel like a, you know, an organic advertising campaign that understands your audience, rather than saying, you know, break into Hollywood now or find a lit agent, 10 easy steps to find a lit, like these sort of cheap SEO sort of world. Mm-hmm. And I really do think it was born from that whole, the SEO sort of thing once the internet came across, right? And everyone just sort of fell into that zone, and it's just lazy marketing. So it's like, what can you do that, you know, is more transparent for one, and that also tells your audience that, hey, we're on the same page. We're not trying to market to you. We're not trying to, we're just, here's what it is. Either you want it or you don't, you know? Again, I don't know if that works, but that's what we're doing.
No, I love that. I mean, I think, you know, you got to try something. And I mean, you know, people like authors are always angry at their agents, and then the agents are angry at the publishers. And but if you actually look at what people are doing, all those jobs are kind of impossible. You know, like if you're agenting a book, if you're publishing a book, it's so difficult to get success in it. So I really get it. And I think it's so cool that you're trying new things, because you can break out and you can actually change the industry. You can disrupt.
Yeah, and that's, and look, if I'm a lit agent at a big company, or if I'm, you know, sort of a middle management person at somewhere, you don't have the luxury of taking chances. You got to play it safe, because it's a very unpredictable economy, and it has been for, I would argue, for almost 20 years now, right? It's just, I understand why people play it safe. I don't know. I've never had that mentality. I think you just have to be honest and try new things. Those will be the top two things. Here's a little fun side fact, if you'd like to hear it. I poured myself some cold brew earlier before we got this call, and I realized that it's concentrate, so I had to water it down. So I've just been drinking straight cold brew this whole time. I might die on this particular podcast, Jeff. And I apologize in advance.
Well, I like you, and it would be a huge loss to the literary world, but it would be great for SEO, since you mentioned
it. Really would. I'm just trying to make it spicier. I'm like, why is this so strong? I'm like, oh god, I think I just had 500 milligrams of caffeine.
Wow, you just added a ticking clock to our whole conversation here.
Well, you gotta have steaks.
If you're listening, please stay tuned. We'll see what happens. if you haven't seen us on the news. All right, so let me just ask you, because I have so many writers that listen to this, and so Fringe Press, you're looking for something that's different. What is it that's different? Like, what is it that the mainstream publishing isn't touching, and why aren't they touching it, and why do you want to touch it?
Well, I'm not going to speak to every genre out there, because I'm not fluent in every genre, honestly. From what I see, it's honestly there's so many parallels between this and the approach I think companies have taken to marketing. It's a lot of playing it safe sort of concepts, just stuff that we've seen before. It's like you said, once one thing is popular, everyone comes in and like, oh, I'm going to write the next Stranger Things. And it's exactly like Stranger Things. It's like, that's not how you get ahead, right? You have to kind of roll the dice and do something that might not feel traditionally marketable, but that hits, I've always talked about the Goldilocks zone between something that's super commercial and something that's super experimental. And the really great projects, books, films, TV shows, whatever, they all kind of fit in that zone, right, at the end of the day. It doesn't have to be something mind-blowingly original, but it just has to be a little bit different. Stories that feel personal, I think, are going to end up resonating the most. I know that your books, you know, obviously they're based on your own real life experiences, and drawing from that, I think, is important. But when it comes to coming up with good, fresh concepts, I just think authors and writers across the board need to have that same mentality of when everyone's zigging, you zag, right? And then maybe it'll work for some, maybe it won't. But you can't zag too much. And that's the challenge of things, right? You can't write something so obscure that it just doesn't resonate. So for ours, you know, this first book that we're publishing, we went through, I don't know, 600 queries, 700 queries, not that many over the course of a year, year and a half. Some agents get 700 a week, I'm told, at this point. And, you know, we got a lot of, you know, good submissions that I thought, this is definitely a book. Someone's going to publish it. It's just, it didn't really get us excited. But when Chris McGinley, the author of Hail Holy Queens, submitted this one, it felt, I don't know, it just popped. It felt like Tarantino meets Robert Eggers meets, I don't know, like a 19th century, you know, gothic novel almost. Robert Eggers is for your audience who doesn't know who Robert Eggers is, he did the latest Nosferatu adaptation, a really interesting director. But it had that vibe to it, and it was really like nothing we had read. But at the same time, it was such an easy pitch. It was nuns versus wolves at the end of the day. These sort of giant wolves that are descending upon their convent in the Berkshires. And that's what sold it. Easy pitch, felt different, and it had something to say. That's probably, in no order of priority, that last one's probably one of the most important. There was a commentary to it, you know. Which again made the pitch even easier. So, if I were an agent or as a publisher, that's everything because that's going to feed into the marketing of it, right?
Don't you think that a theme, or you say having something to say, isn't that maybe the most critical part in anything to keep it from just being shallow or just being something that has no heft to it? You know, like you want to learn mm-hmm. something as a reader, you want to experience something, you want to look at humanity a different way, or put yourself in the head of somebody who you disagree with. Is that, I mean, that seems like a really big thing that maybe some authors miss.
I think it's number one, but here's the caveat to me, and I'm curious what your thoughts are on this as an author. I don't know if you start there in the development of a new idea. I don't know if you start with theme or if you just find something that feels cool and then the theme kind of comes organically later. I know that I went back to fiction writing a few years ago, and I know with my book, that I'm querying now, by the way, and it's a nightmare process, and I sympathize with all of you authors out there. It's not a nightmare. It's just it's a long road, right? But no, when I wrote that one, I wasn't really thinking of theme. I was starting with like, all right, what's a cool setting and what's a cool situation? And then as you're writing, it just kind of comes out. But I'm curious, is that the case with most authors, or is it the reverse?
No, that for me anyhow, right? I think everyone's a little different in how they come to story. I usually have the what if. I have a high concept and I start with a high concept, but then immediately after that, you know, I populate it with a character and what's that character arc. But right away, like at the beginning, I have to think, what's this book about? You know, like, what is it? Is it a redemption story? You know, I mean, what is it about? And then that's when the themes come out. A lot of times I'll finish a book and then realize there was another theme in it that I hadn't realized till I finished, you know. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I think it's really important at the beginning to understand what you're really talking about. And it can be, it's sort of a guiding light to us, you know, it's something you can follow as you go.
Right. When you, I know you're interviewing me, but I'm a natural interviewer, not a natural guest, I'm sorry. But when you're writing something, have you ever come up with something that you're like, oh, this is a great concept. I got the story. You know, you crack the plot and everything, but you never really figured out like what you were trying to say with it, and so you abandoned it.
Yeah, I'm like a story machine. Honestly, I love it. It's one of the things I like. Like this weekend, I had three novel ideas. And when they come to me, I usually outline them. I'll put them into three or four acts. I'll think of the character. I'll have have the ending. And I did the three of them just this weekend. So I have I have probably 300 ideas like that I'm trying to get to, but I won't live long enough, you know? So yes. I mean, that does happen where I'm like, okay, this is like, that's a really cool what if type of thing. Or sometimes it's a character first, like this would be such a cool setting, and then you know, and then how this character would change, and then but I'm like, okay, it's just not quite there yet, it needs more work. So it's not that I abandoned it, it's just that other things jump to the forefront.
Right. I thought I had a lot of ideas. I'm like, I've got like 15 that I think I could write next. You know, 300 over here.
Yeah, it's hundreds. I get them all the time. But you know, honestly, if I don't write them down, they disappear. They just I think a lot of people have ideas, they just forget them.
Yeah, they do. Quickly. That's why you have to write them down. That's a big tip for any writer listening to this.
So when you talk about Fringe, you're talking about experimental stuff. I get it if it's like too experimental in that, like, you know, it's like the book that's all one sentence. I've seen those, right? There's all these weird literary techniques that are experimental and hard. I get that. But there's also this kind of homogenous storytelling accepted by, you know, Big Five Publishing. And you'll see this where they say, oh, no, you know, where will we shelve this particular book? And it's these two different genres. And that doesn't work. And someone writes like a mixed genre book and it blows up. Then everybody wants that mix of those two genres. You know, and you see this all the time. So I think I'm so excited. I'll be a big supporter of this. I'm anxious to see how it goes.
Yeah, I don't like the whole, and I get it, I'm practical and I'm, you know, from business-minded about, what you know, when it comes to where is this book going to live on the shelf? And it's like, well, if it's really good and you don't know where it lives, just build another shelf. Like, it's not that hard, right?
Oh,
there's
love
plenty
it.
Of room.
I love it.
Build a shelf, yeah. I mean, you're not creating new genres necessarily. Everything's going to be kind of a blend of something else. But 30 years ago, you know, where was Romantasy at? Was Romantasy even a formal term? I mean, there was Romantasy books out there, but I don't know if it was a formal term. Maybe it was. I'm sorry if my history of publishing isn't quite as polished as my history of advertising. But now that's a thing, right? They'll just invent new shit. Like, they're trying to give the impression that writers need to box themselves in when the stuff that they want is outside the box. So there's kind of a disconnect there, I think. And no wonder so many authors are confused about, like, what to write and who's looking for what and this and that. I think, you know, if it's a more – I mean, you're writing in a more down-the-middle genre, I think, typically, right? Although maybe one of your other 300 ideas are something outside of that. It's a political thriller romanticy. There you go. But, you know, for the most part, I think a good story is a good story, and it's going to live where it's going to live. So,
yeah, no, I agree. I totally agree. So we have lots of authors that come here. I recently had Adam Meyer gave a talk at our literary salon about getting books into film. And so you're with your Pipeline Media. You're doing all kinds of really interesting things. So I'd like to chat about some of that. Tell us about, like, the script pipeline. This is for screen and big screen and TV writers, correct?
It's for screenwriters and TV writers, yeah.
And what is it you're looking to do, and what are you looking for? Tell us a little bit about that.
So script pipeline, script, book, and film, they're all mostly competition-based platforms. So for our finalists and winners every year, we're very hands-on with our development process and our circulation process. It's really kind of become, in recent years, more about being hands-on with development and getting their scripts, you know, ready for circulation, making those connections, but really making it a long-term sort of almost a mentoring sort of process with those writers, as our bandwidth will allow anyway. But we've been able to kind of keep in touch with pretty much all of them, whoever wants to come back and, you know, have more material reviewed, or, you know, can be as hands-on as they want. But that's been very successful over the years. The film and TV industry, I won't bore you with the details, but it's been, you know, kind of in a tumultuous state at the moment, especially for TV. But for film, everyone wants a great new spec. I think the problem in film and TV has been there's no roadmap like there is in publishing, where you write a query and you polish your query and you send your query to lit agents and the lit agent signs you, and, you know, there's a map there, right? In screenwriting, it's kind of all over the place. A lot of companies aren't open to queries and so on and so forth. So, you know, trying to make those connections, again, for our finalists and winners is going to be even more important, I think, as we move forward. So that's the layout for script pipeline. Book pipeline, to jump ahead to your inevitable question about book pipeline, I'm sure. I've also had, you know, a cup of cold brew concentrate. So if I'm babbling on, please stop.
If you start sweating, I'm dialing 911.
Yes, you have to call the local hospital. For book pipeline, it's the same sort of process. We're actually just announcing our unpublished competition winners this Friday. I was judging more entries, the final entries here, before I got on the Zoom. I read one, again, it's my third time reading the sample and the synopsis because I love it so much, and I think that'll be my winner pick. So this is kind of a, you know, sort of like our Christmas where we get to, like, tell people that we love them and they're good. So that's coming Friday. For our adaptation contest, we look for published novels, published nonfiction, published comics, and published and unpublished short stories for film and TV adaptation. Just announced the winner for that one yesterday. So that'll be great. We'll talk to the writer tomorrow, who won. Her name's Becca Day. She wrote The Woman in the Cabin. It's a thriller. Came out fairly recently and did very well. And very twisty sort of thriller that we felt had the most film potential out of the other 1,200 entries. So we'll see what we can get going with that one. But yeah, it's kind of the process for both those platforms. And film is helping filmmakers finance their shorts, develop their stuff.
So when you tell people they've won, do you do that via email? Do you call them? How does that go?
Winners get a call, typically. In Becca's case for adaptation yesterday, she's in the UK, and I was kind of under the gun to announce it, so I didn't have time to figure out the time difference and give her, you know, reach her. So she was an email. But all the winners, yeah. If you're getting a call from Pipeline, you've probably won. Or you're in huge trouble over something. I don't know. But
how much fun is that to tell somebody they've won? Because these are tough businesses.
You know, I was totaling up, speaking of how many scripts I've read, I was thinking about it yesterday on how many winner calls I've made between script, book, and film over the years. And it's probably over, like, I don't know, 300, I guess. I mean, there's been a lot. Most of them are, like, legitimately excited. Sometimes you get, like, a deadpan response, like, oh, that's really cool. I'm like, oh, all right, I'm fine. Yes. Or they're too nervous, or that, you know, getting a call to say you've won something and that we're going to send you money is kind of a nerve-wracking call, I'm sure, in its own right.
Well, it's like, you know, everyone gets approached by all these scammers all the time. My first 10 emails every morning are people like inviting me to book clubs that are all scams, you know, and it's so hard because you have to look at them because you never know when they're real, because I do get invited to real book clubs and I do speak to book clubs. So you got to go to one.
Scammy book club invite?
Oh, yeah. This is huge right now. So, you know, we're in December 2025, and this is for the last like 2 or 3 months. It's just been getting worse and worse and worse. And they're AI driven. So you can kind of tell by the tone. A lot of times they'll use some of the same language, and they'll come in, they'll say, oh, we're inviting you to the Seattle Silent Book Club or whatever it is. And sometimes they'll use the name of real book clubs. So even if you look up the club, you say, oh, it's a real club. And, you know, authors get invited. I get invited all the time to book clubs, you know, so you have to look, but they're looking to engage with you. And then they'll down the road, there's money down the road. There's some kind of commitment, right? They're looking to engage, but they're all scams. And this has become a really big thing. Like, there's been a lot of posts and forums, like on Authors Guild and various places about this, but I get 10 of these a day.
Good Lord.
And then that also branches out into the publicists and the marketers and those we've always had. But it's getting worse because of AI. So a human being doesn't have to do it. They're just going out to these lists. And, you know, I can tell when they're just pulling information off of the internet someplace, whether it's like Amazon or wherever. And they'll talk about your book as if they've read it. So they'll, you know, oh, this is great. And based on your background, and, you know, and they'll give you all this insight stuff. But it doesn't take long. Once you get about 100 of these, you can pick them out.
When with AI, now that they can scan your book immediately and just tell you, like, oh, I love what you did with Tristan, the romantic lead, or whatever. What a nightmare. I got fooled on that note real quick. The PR people email us for How the Arts Were Won, our one of our Pipeline podcasts, almost daily. And in the beginning, I'm like, oh, they're reaching out to us because we're popular now. It's like, no, you're not popular. And I've learned to ignore them. But
I think everyone's fallen for it at some point. And if you're being diligent and you're trying to be responsive to readers and be responsive, you know, you have to, eventually you're going to get fooled because it's indistinguishable at the beginning. It's really hard to figure this out.
Yeah. If we've met you at a conference, then I'm like, you're probably real. So we'll have you on.
So far. But I mean, they'll be able to mimic people. They can do it now with voice too, right? Voice and video. And that's it's getting harder and harder to discern whether you're talking to an AI or not. At our literary salon, we get calls here all the time, and I used to be able to tell right away. Now it's much harder. You can, and then I'll realize I'm talking to an AI.
I put into doubt this entire conversation. I don't know. There's a weird backlight behind you. I don't know if that means. It's
yes. Yeah. Yeah. I'm gonna transform into a robot or something now. Right. Gotcha.
Right.
So you mentioned that the movie industry is sort of tumultuous right now, or TV. I have a lot of friends that are script writers, and like, you know, there's more outlets than there's ever been before for you to get stuff out. But I've also heard from a lot of writers that the work is really dried up and they're going to smaller and smaller pools of writers. Is that true? And tell us, like, what has changed and why?
Well, for TV, it's true. For TV, it went from 600 plus scripted shows to now it's like 300 plus, so they say. It feels like there's less even that than even that. I'm talking about U.S. you know, mm-hmm. English language shows. So you know, when it cuts in half, and the writers' rooms are restructured in such a way where, you know, there's lower level writers and there's mid level writers, upper level writers. No one's really hiring lower level writers. So then, well, how do you crack into the industry? You can't jump to the upper level and all of a sudden be a showrunner. So that whole pipeline and that proving ground, well, not proving ground, but that whole process of, education, I guess, is sort of gone. So I don't know how you rise the ranks when you've cut out the lobby of the building, right? So that's true. It is slimming down in TV. I still think there's going to be more opportunities. Manager friends will tell me I'm crazy when I say this, but there's going to be more opportunities for new unproduced writers if they have something that's truly spectacular, like a TV show pitch, to possibly sell a show. So maybe that becomes the goal instead of like trying to get staffed, which is good news for. Not to be ageist, but this is just how it is in the industry. The older writers, the writing for TV was never really like something you could crack into in your 50s and your 60s, right? It would be like the person in their 20s, and that would they would do that for 5 years, and they would be a mid-level writer for 5 years, and they would kind of grow with that. So I don't know. I optimistically, maybe it'll create to some degree more opportunities. On the film side, though. Just age, AI, identity. You could be a robot. If you write a really great script, I'm sure you can sell it. There's never been a higher, and I mean this when I say this, there's really never been a higher demand for really great specs. Spec meaning, if you're the author crowd that is listening to this, is not a spec script, it's something that you write on spec and send out to managers, production companies. Huge demand for genre stuff, good action stuff, horror, thriller, anything that feels big and high concept, but is still, again, in that sort of Goldilocks zone in terms of concepts, that has a chance. Again, never seen a bigger demand for it, but then everyone's still very picky. So, good luck. That is my rambling advice.
Here's it right up. Thank you so much.
Yeah.
So one of the questions I hear a lot from people is they want to know, like, especially from like authors who haven't written scripts before, they haven't sold anything, they haven't had anything produced. They want to know what they can make from these things. And I'm sure it's different for on demand or television or movies. And there's probably a huge spectrum within that. But just roughly, like, if you're selling a spec script or you're not doing there's various. Right. There's probably, what, three versions of scripts that go out before production. Is that correct?
Three versions of scripts that go out.
There's a spec script, and here's your idea, here's the thing, and then before the actual shooting script is different, right? With camera direction and things. There's multiple versions, right?
Yeah, I mean all that really does vary. But as far as how much you can make, you mean monetarily, right?
Yeah.
Not in terms of like good vibes.
Yeah, people are just curious, like, if I put this effort into this and I have like a movie goes to the big screen, what as the writer could I get?
Oh, you're not quitting your job. I mean, it's just like publishing a book. You're not going to be quitting your day job, I don't think. This is the arts, and I think people have to be realistic about, like, how things actually happen. Now, have we had writers who have never produced anything before, were never rep before, sell a spec for $2 million, for $3 million? Yes. It happened in 2020, and it happened in Snow White and the Huntsman, who you mentioned before, and the bio with Evan Doherty. And then Crosby, Seal, and Derselle, Bring Me Back in 2020 for a little over $2 million. And he actually got paid right away for it, which is a miracle in itself. And I know this because he moved to Los Angeles and bought a house. And I'm pretty sure that was the first tell that he actually, this actually was a real deal. That's very rare, right? Those two I just mentioned, those were two of the biggest spec sales from a previously unproduced writer in like the history of Hollywood.
Wow. I'm
very proud to say they came through us. But, you know, it depends on what, it depends on where the script is going. If it's, you know, we just published an article today on Pipeline Artists from a writer, Kim Hornsby, who writes a lot of like Hallmark type movies. Those are smaller. You're getting, you know, I don't know what you're getting for those, $5,000, $10,000 maybe. Not much, right? But those movies are getting made because they're low budget and they churn them out. And there's a demand for that, for that market. It's a much bigger market than I think most people realize. So there's that level of writers, and that's totally fine. There's, you know, if you sell a spec to a studio, right, and it's, you know, it gets a manager and it gets packaged, it could sell for low six figures, mid six figures. A few specs this year sold for in the millions. You know, it's just wildly, wildly varies, but it really does depend on the type of film you're writing. If you're writing a small, indie, low-concept drama, that's not going to sell for $3 million, most likely, right? A year ago, or was it 2 years ago now, there was that script After the Hunt. The movie just came out, Julia Roberts. That was a spec script that sold, I think, high six figures or the seven figures. But, you know, if you're a writer and you're repped, let's say you do sell a spec for $1 million, right? Well, your manager's going to get 10%. If you have an agent in that deal, they're going to get 10%. Attorney's going to get 5%, right? So that's 25% gone. Then you got to pay taxes on it. You know, all of a sudden, you can live off that for a year, 2 years, depending on the final price. But this idea that – this is a much longer answer to your question, but hopefully it was informative – this idea that you're going to sell a script and then all of a sudden become a millionaire is false, right? Especially if you're just kind of a one-off writer and you're not really looking to be a career screenwriter.
So, how important is it to have a manager and an agent and an attorney?
Yeah, to sell a spec, I don't know anybody who's sold a spec without a manager or an agent, for that matter. It's just you're not going to get the script into the hands of the right people. I'm sure it's happened. I don't know anybody who's done that. You don't really need a lit agent, I don't think, until later. It's usually kind of the progression is get a manager first. Although I've known writers who just have an agent and never had a manager. But usually the process is manager. They'll kind of help you find an agent. Agents have been really picky about signing new writers lately. And then entertainment attorneys. Some writers just have an entertainment attorney, and they kind of know they've negotiated their own deals, or they have a lit agent and an entertainment attorney. So that's kind of the progression, though. Manager, probably an entertainment attorney, then you get to lit agent later. Very different in publishing, obviously.
Yeah, very, very different. So, like, going through Pipeline Media, what is the process? Like, how should a writer approach this?
So it's really like there's two channels. It's either you're entering a competition or you're submitting for notes. We have note services on Book Pipeline that, if I can plug it really quick, I think are really great and very cost effective. Do query edits and things like that. So the contest, you know, if you're placing as a finalist or winner, obviously there's a development process and a sort of mentorship and long term consulting that we do on that front. With workshop submissions, so if you're submitting for notes, if one of our readers reads something that they think is really great, they'll recommend it to me or to Kira, who runs Book Pipeline, or to Brian Michael, who run Script Pipeline. Then they'll take a look, and if they think it's good, they'll bump it up to me, and I'll take a look and be like, hey, you know, like maybe this could be a good match for X, Y, and Z company. And we work with the writer and say, hey, you know, are you repped and what's the status of the project? And we'll help make those connections too. So, and then other times we get, most of it is just former finalists and winners of ours who maybe they were repped and lost their reps, and now they're coming back and saying, hey, I have a new spec. Do you want to read it? And we'll read it and see what we can do with that one. We got a writer signed, a few writers signed this year who were former finalists who had already been repped, and then they kind of broke up with their reps, and we helped find them new and hopefully better ones. Done that on the bookend a little bit too. And I've very proudly this year, we had one Script Pipeline finalist of ours, Laura Bensick, who placed in 2016, so about almost 10 years ago now. She ended up turning that TV pilot into a novel. Her agents that rep her for film and TV, the lit agent at that company, I guess she couldn't quite find a lit agent there, so she's like, I'm going to go out with it wide. Can you help? And we were able to find her a really great lit agent on that one. So everything's kind of intertwined in this pipeline, like synergistic universe after a while. So, and it all kind of revolves around like just doing whatever we can for those writers who might skew off into other mediums or, you know, the representation status changes and so forth.
That's so valuable. If you're a writer, you have a book, do you recommend they write a script for it or just go with the book?
No, just go with the book. Unless you want to be a screenwriter too, and then yeah, write the script. But there's no value to writing the script when you don't want to write the script, that's for sure. And vice versa. If you're a screenwriter and you're finding it difficult and you really don't want to be a novelist, then don't be a novelist. But if it's something you want to explore, my advice is 1,000% explore it, because you never know. That might be the thing that you're better at and that you like even more. You know,
how much does it help to have a book that's sold well if you're trying to have it produced?
That's a loaded question. I think I look at our adaptation winner this year as an example. Ultimately, you know, our judging process, it's the concept of, think there's a place for the story in the film and TV market. But looking at like book sales and things, that doesn't hurt, certainly. You look at something like The Hunting Wives, which took off, right? May Cobb's book, and that was the Netflix series. It's a great series too. You guys should watch it. But if that was a self-published book, would it have gotten a Netflix deal? No. It needed that boost, I would think, anyway. May Cobb would be the person to talk to more than me about her own the progress of her own project. But I don't know. It really does depend. If it's a project that's so original and so cool and it manages to get to somebody of influence, then it doesn't matter, I don't think. But to get it there, it kind of needs that extra oomph.
So is it that the book, say, that did well already has readership and people that would be interested in seeing it in a different medium? Or is it just the visibility so that the producers would be more familiar with the work? Or is it both?
I think it's both. But I also think, and this is perhaps subjective, but I really do think this, when other people like something, it gets validation. And then validation creates, buzz, and then buzz creates demand, right? I think I got that flow right.
Yeah.
It's the same thing when you send out a script and it's like, oh, if you find out that Blumhouse loves it and, Universal wants it and Jordan Peele wants it, all of a sudden you're more likely to like it. Yeah. It's just human nature, right? Well, if all these people like it, then it must be good. Yeah. So it's that same sort of momentum, and that it's just the snowball going down the hill.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of behavioral economics and social psychology on that, and that creates a fear of missing out, right? That's why you get these auctions for things that were previously just rejected all over the place. But when one person wants it, suddenly everybody wants it.
Yes, which is so lame and so artificial. And I know some of you are just rolling your eyes and like, that's not how it should work. And I know, but that's 5,000 years of human nature.
Do you see, like, because, it's the way it works in Hollywood, it seems like it's so relationship-based, kind of old school in a lot of ways. It's not as structured as, like, trying to query with books. Do you think that's going to change with AI and the way that AI is going to have a greater and greater role in the production of movies?
I hope not. And I'm saying this as someone who's not, like, I am anti-AI just because it's largely kind of dumb and unnecessary. I mean, there's going to be places for it, but I say I hope not, just because I don't think that's It's not an automated process. Nor do I think like reviewing resumes is an automated process. A lot of companies, big companies, are using AI now to go through resumes, right? So I'm told. Because the judging art, because that's what this is, not to get too like artsy with everybody, but like judging art is so dependent on human perception and not like a formula to me. Can you use AI to go through books that are like completely like horribly formatted and stuff? I suppose, but what if it misses something? The risk to me is always like, what if I miss something? When we're judging or what have you, and we put so many little parachutes in place to make sure that we don't miss anything with potential. We still are probably like something that might be good, but not ready yet. And you know, whatever. But I just don't think AI can replicate that. So I hope not, but it might.
Well, no, I think you're right, because it's in the end, it's the emotion that you're trying to evoke in a viewer or a reader, and AI doesn't have emotion. Right. So that's something it can look for triggers and keywords and things. And you know, when you talk about resumes, it's funny because a lot of companies are using this to vet resumes, but then people have figured out, well, they're looking for things that match what their criteria is. So I'll just use all the words in their job ad in my resume and to get selected, you know. So it almost turns into what you're talking about earlier with the big five looking for things that have worked in the past. Everything suddenly starts to sound the same.
And now we're in SEO hell again, where it's just all about keywords.
I love it.
It's a dystopian nightmare. It's the lamest dystopian movie you can ever imagine.
So this is a good chance for where we're getting close here, but just for our readers, you vet this, you've read or viewed 75,000 works. What is it in pitching that works and what doesn't work? To give our viewers some sense of what it is in a pitch for a movie and or a book that grabs your attention. Like, how should they be writing these?
Okay, so I have an answer to this, but it's going to feel a little bit ambiguous, but I'm going to give you it anyway. There has to be something in the pitch that makes me go, oh, like, that makes you kind of, like, have that visceral reaction of, like, you almost kind of laugh to yourself because it's, like, it's something that's clever or unexpected. And it seems really hard to do, and it is hard to do, but it's not impossible, right? I can't pitch the stuff that we've read this week yet anyway for Book Pipeline, but there were a few where I'm like, oh, it's a romantic comedy, but it's not a romantic comedy because there's this little tiny twist in it. And I will tell you the one through line seed in all of these pitches that make me have that reaction is you can see the conflict without even knowing the plot, if that makes sense. Maybe there's a better way you can explain that as an author, Jeff. But, like, you know what I'm saying. Like, you see the conflict within the setup and the way it's pitched. We don't even need to know, like, the rest of the story. It's like we can see it going on all these different tangents. And that formula is – I don't think it's that difficult to kind of capture. But what's difficult is making it original enough to stand out. And I don't have the magic – the magic solution for that, but it is that something in the pitch that makes us see what the stakes are, what the conflict is, just in the sentence.
So I guess almost the flip side of that would be, because you're right, your readers, agents, everybody's looking for something new and different. But I always feel like it's this artificial environment with, like, I talk to a lot of agents about this, you know, where they just see sometimes 100 pitches a day, right? So they see so much, like, oh, I've heard this before. But just because they've heard it before, because they're getting all these pitches, the average reader's not getting all these pitches, or the average movie watcher's not getting all these pitches. Correct. So how much of that is real, and how much of that is just because a lot of people are, you know, there's only 27 storylines in human history or something?
Yeah, well, you know, related to that, it's hard when you're an industry person. I'm always careful, like, to kind of take a step back and say, okay, this might feel like a generic story we've seen before, but you know, maybe the writing elevates it. Maybe you know, you kind of get into this zone where your blinders start narrowing and narrowing and narrowing, and it's really good to, like, take a step back and really look at it for what it is. But I'm not saying industry don't do that, but I'm sorry, I've strayed from your original question.
Yeah, no, it was just basically because you're in the industry and you're seeing all these pitches, you have an idea of something you've seen so often, but not the reader or viewer necessarily hasn't seen that. So it sounds familiar to you, but maybe there's been one movie made like that or a handful of books like that.
Right. And I think that's okay. I think it's, if something's been kind of done before, as long as it hasn't been recent, you know, that's okay. As long as yours has enough of a twist to where it can be presented and marketed differently. Look, I can give you two quick examples too, as far as like pitches that I think are really good. In fact, I'll use the French Press book as one of them. Why not? So it was presented to us. It was this woman is in an abusive relationship with her husband, who thinks that she has gone crazy because she likes to write.
19th century. It's hitting a little close to home here.
Yeah, it is. So he's like, you're going to go live with the nuns for a while and like figure your shit out. I'm paraphrasing, obviously. This is not exactly. So she goes to this convent in the middle of nowhere in the Berkshires in Western Massachusetts. And she finds out that the nuns are organizing a hunting party to go after this beast that lives in the woods called the gulo that is attacking their convent, right? And the organized hunting party, they go after the wolf, they kill it, find out there's more of them out there, they go back to their convent. And this mysterious nun shows up from France, and she's like, this has happened before, these are beasts that hunt holy people, and you know, I'm gonna teach you the ways of hunting the wolf. And from there on, it's nuns versus wolves, and it's the coolest thing, right? And I'm like, this is an easy pitch. The backdrop is something I really haven't seen before, but it still feels a little familiar to where it's not like, you know, completely outlandish. It's monsters fighting X, right? But the whole thing felt very feminist horror to me. It felt very much like a commentary on attacks on faith and safe spaces and that sort of thing. And there was just a lot to pick apart. But the way he pitched it, I forget what the original, like, you know, one paragraph pitch was, but I'm like, okay, I get it. It's about religion. It's about, you know, the safety of women. It's about, group dynamics. It's about this and that. But it's also like, you know, people's jaws getting torn apart by monstrous wolves. And I found that cool.
Yeah, it sounds really cool. Sounds great. How important is like the tagline when you're pitching as a writer? Or, you know, the log line or the tagline or the this meets that or whatever to help get your idea across.
I think it helps a lot. I don't think you necessarily need a this meets that as much in lit agents will disagree with me on this probably in publishing. I think if you pitch it well enough, it should be clear. And the person reading it is educated on what's been out there in the market and over the last 100 years of books. They'll kind of see the comps themselves. But you know, in screenwriting, the logline is kind of everything as a new writer. I've seen industry professionals, older industry professionals who kind of came up in the 90s and even before that, say the logline doesn't matter. I've never had to write a logline. I'm like, I don't know what you're talking about. Everyone needs a logline, so don't let them sway you. But yeah, something simple like that. My other example, by the way, was going to be Weapons, if you've seen Weapons. That one's in the movie that came out this year. I won't spoil it, but like the basic pitch is all these 20 children from the same classroom in this small town disappear, except for one kid, and they have to figure out where they went. That's it. I get it. It could be supernatural. It could be true crime. It could be anything. It doesn't really matter what the, you know, what the genre is going into it. But, I'm already invested. I want to know what happened to the kids and why they all came from the same classroom. It's all about dropping little breadcrumbs and really kind of sparking our curiosity in the pitch.
I think that's it exactly, right? It's like if you hear the pitch and you're like, I have to know what happens or I have to know what goes on here. If you can get that reaction in any reader, agent, whoever, you're gonna have good luck.
Yeah, without making them say, well, who cares?
Right.
I could easily say, well, who cares what happened to the kids? It's like, well, no, it's interesting.
Do you see any common mistakes or like what the worst mistake or something that writers should not do when they're pitching?
Pitching something that has very obviously been done a million times before and there's no twist to it. don't do that. You can rely on the execution. Maybe the execution's brilliant. Maybe you're the next Tom Stoppard. I don't know. But Tom Stoppard's on my head because he just passed. If you're a new writer and you're trying to break in with a book or a script, it really does rely a lot on the concept. Now, that said, we've gotten plenty of writers signed with scripts that I didn't think the concept was, again, not mind-blowingly original, but the execution was. So you can take kind of a basic concept. After the Hunt's a great example, that spec that sold. It's a campus, like, rape assault allegation story, which is like the heaviest subject matter, and you would think that that wouldn't be a hot spec, but the way she wrote it was just so engaging and so dynamic and so raw and grounded and real that, you know, it just sort of elevated the whole thing. So I don't want to give the impression that, like, oh, it's the concept or death, right? There's ways to get in it, but again, the through line is something about it, whether the execution or the idea itself, has to feel fresh and original and honest, I think, to some extent.
So you mentioned that you were you've just written a novel and you're in the querying stage yourself. Do you want to tell us anything about it? Get that get out there? Okay.
No, I can't. This one is, I wanted to do a spin on the coming of age story. I don't really like coming of age stories because a lot of them tend to be like, oh, this teenager loves this teenager, and then like they can't, like, you know, be together because of, like, you know, it's just all very we've seen it.
Romeo and Juliet, right?
Yeah, it peaked at Romeo. Shakespeare did it. It was 600 years ago. And a lot of those stories are very good, and I like a lot of them. But it's either that, or like one of them's dying, or like one of them has to, like, deal with, like, you know, like, oh my god, their home life is fine. That's all good. That's all part of the coming of age. I wanted to write something that had no romantic element, and it was more about friendship and how we connect with other people and our peers, right? So it's set in a near future New York where this law that's been in place for a number of years where if you're under the age of 18, you can't go out in public unless you have a parent or a certified chaperone with you. And that was kind of the starting place for me to look at it from a societal angle, like, what if your coming of age is suppressed by the government, essentially, right? And you can't go out and sort of be alone with friends, and how that would change, and what would happen if someone tried to, like, upset that dynamic. So it takes place over the course of one day, more or less, and pretty straightforward coming of age.
Oh, it's so interesting. Yeah.
No, the speculative fiction angle, I guess.
It sounds really cool. Yeah, I haven't heard that before, you know, so that's everything you just talked about, right? Something is kind of unique in the of the one day, so you've got your pacing will be good. I mean, I love it.
Yeah. Yeah, and I wrote about this briefly on Pipeline Artists in an article a few months ago, but, like, it's just the George Costanza method, and I believe in this strongly. If everything I've done is wrong, then the opposite must be right. So just do the opposite. If everyone's writing coming-of-age stuff that is about romance and about forsaken teenage love, and there's werewolves and vampires or whatever, somehow, in the fantasy ones, I guess, what's the opposite of that? Take out the romantic element, and then what are you left with? Like, well, what's more universal than that, even? And it's like, well, friendship and connection and needing to form those bonds between other people is more important than, I think, love, because teenage love really doesn't exist. I'm sorry, that's controversial, but
I love George, it. Yeah. Costanza method. Hi, I'm George. I'm unemployed and I live with my parents.
Yes, that's the deal. I'm Veronica. I can quote Seinfeld too if you'd like.
We just did.
I know. Hey, we did it.
Perfect. Seinfeld still is relevant.
Yes. Seinfeld's another great example of itself doing the opposite, because there was no sitcom like it before that, right? They billed it as the show about nothing. Obviously, it wasn't about nothing, but that was their market angle, and it worked. It became the most successful sitcom of all time, right?
Absolutely the greatest sitcom of all time in my I've seen them all a dozen times.
Right. So.
All right. So if a writer is interested in Pipeline Media, where should they go?
Yeah. You know what the best starting point is? Just the main almost a corporate website, but we're not really a corporation, whatever. Just pipelinemediagroup.com. That'll be kind of like the funnel to all the other divisions. We have Symposium, our educational platform. Those are one-off Zoom events. We do a good handful of original podcasts, of which Jeff was a guest on. And digital magazine, Pipeline Artists, where we publish short stories, we've interviews, articles, essays, things like that. Then our division sites. So that's the starting point, pipelinemediagroup.com.
Wow, you guys are doing so much. I mean, really, you've got like every aspect, right? Much. You're there. Right. It's a lot. I mean, you'd think you'd have about 500 people working for you.
Yeah, no, I just need cold brew concentrate. Straight.
You have a chemical workforce working for you.
God, it's like Bourbon Street over here.
And for a fringe press for this book, you said, was it March that it comes out?
Shooting for early March as the release.
And where should people go for that?
That'll be fringepublishers.com. Or just follow us on social, because I will be posting about it endlessly until people are like, I have to read the Nun book, because you won't shut up about it.
Well, you know, it sounds fantastic, and I wish you luck with your book, too. I think that should be a lot of fun. I don't know where you find the time to do all these things. You're wearing a lot of hats.
Yeah, well, I have a lot of hats. As you see on many podcasts, I have a different hat on every time.
Well, I'm a bald guy, so I appreciate that. As you can imagine, I'm
an aspiring, bald guy. So
I love it.
Prepping for the future.
Well, Matt, thank you so much. This has been a lot of fun. We really appreciate having you on, and we wish you luck, and we'll try to catch up with you in the future.
Wonderful. Thank you, Jeff.
Thank you.